Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay, so we'll continue with this, mindfulness, the gatekeeper. The next section is on right view, right mindfulness, right effort. The role played by mindfulness in applying memory of the past to present activities for the sake of present and future results is best illustrated by a passage in Majjhima 117, which is the Mahajatarisaka Sutta, the Great 40, in which the Buddha presents the first seven factors of the Noble Eightfold Path as requisites for right concentration, the final factor of the path. With each of the first five factors, the three factors of right view, right mindfulness, and right effort work together to abandon the wrong version of the factor and to develop the right version as an aid in noble right concentration. For example, with the factor of right resolve, right view is the forerunner. And how is right view the forerunner? One discerns wrong resolve as wrong resolve and right resolve as right resolve. That's sammāsaṅkhaṃpa. This is one's right view. One makes an effort for abandoning wrong resolve and for entering into right resolve. This is one's right effort. One is mindful to abandon wrong resolve and to enter and remain in right resolve. This is one's right mindfulness. Thus, these three qualities, right view, right effort, and right mindfulness, run and circle around right resolve. And that actually repeats all through the sutta. This aspect of right mindfulness comes under the fourth frame of reference in the establishing of mindfulness, keeping mental qualities in and of themselves in mind as a frame of reference. In this role, right mindfulness builds on right view and remembers to apply right effort to develop each factor of the path. The standard definition of right view is that it pertains not just to the factors of the path, the fourth noble truth, but also to all four noble truths. And its relation to those truths, dukkha, its origination, its cessation, and the path of practice leading to its cessation, is not simply a matter of knowing what they are, it's a matter of knowing in terms of those truths. The phrase "in terms of," again expressed by the locative case, means that right view uses the four truths as a framework for classifying experiences as they happen. Knowing which experiences count as dukkha or stress or unsatisfactoriness, suffering, which count as the origination of dukkha, and so forth. One of the duties of right mindfulness is to keep this framework in mind and to apply it to present experience. However, the Buddha's first exposition of right view in Saṅgyutta 56.11, which is the Dhammacakka Sutta, shows that there is more to right view than just a framework of four truths. It also includes the motivation for adopting a framework, as well as the duties enjoined by the framework. In the Buddha's exposition, the motivation actually comes first. Before introducing the framework, he explains why it should be adopted. It's part of a path that, avoiding the extremes of sensual indulgence and self-mortification, both of which lead to suffering, leads to stilling, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding, to nibbana. That is, to total freedom from suffering. So that's that. The phrase upasamaya abhinyaya sambodhaya nibbanaya. By beginning with this motivation, the Buddha indicates the role that desire has to play in the path. For as we just noted, all phenomena, even the path, are rooted in desire. In recognition of this fact, he starts with an explanation of why you would desire to adopt the framework of the Four Noble Truths. After explaining the framework, the Buddha points out that each truth carries a duty. Dukkha is to be comprehended, its origination abandoned, its cessation realized, and the path to its cessation developed. Only when these duties have been completed is total awakening achieved. So right view consists of three parts: a framework for viewing experience, an understanding of the motivation for adopting the framework, and a knowledge of what should be done in light of the framework. All three parts of this knowledge are what right mindfulness remembers and applies to the present. It remembers to keep a particular frame of reference in mind, it remembers the purpose for keeping it in mind, and it remembers lessons from the past, things said or done, unquote, by oneself or others, that indicate what would be best to do in any given present situation in light of that frame of reference, taken within the overall framework of the Four Noble Truths. In the context of the passage from Majjhima 117, the Great 40, this would mean recognizing that right and wrong resolve as mental qualities fall under the fourth frame of reference, remembering what distinguishes wrong resolve from right resolve, remembering the duty appropriate to each, that is, abandoning wrong resolve and entering and remaining in right resolve, as well as remembering why it's worthwhile to make the effort to fulfill these duties. Any questions? Have I lost anybody? It's quite good, quite clear. Excellent. Okay, this is where right mindfulness connects directly with right effort. For it directs right effort in light of the three aspects of right view. It remembers the framework of the Four Noble Truths, which, in the formula of right effort, is translated into the distinction between skillful and unskillful qualities. It remembers the motivation provided by right view so as to generate the desire central to right effort. And it remembers the duties appropriate to the Four Noble Truths, which are translated into slightly different terms in the formula for right effort. The effort to prevent the arising of unskillful qualities that have yet to arise, and to abandon unskillful qualities that have already arisen, corresponds to the abandoning of the second noble truth. The effort to give rise to skillful qualities and to develop them once they have arisen corresponds to the developing of the fourth noble truth. The effort to bring the skillful qualities of the path, and in particular the quality of discernment, wisdom, panya, to the culmination of their development requires the comprehension of the first noble truth and leads to the realization of the third. In this way, the primary duty of right mindfulness is to remember to keep these aspects of right effort in line with the three aspects of right view. However, there is some complexity in the relationship between right mindfulness and right effort in this project, for these two factors are not radically distinct. Right mindfulness doesn't simply give directions and motivation to right effort, for right effort is actually a part of right mindfulness. This is indicated in the Satipatthana formula not only by the presence of the quality of ardency, but also by the concluding passage of the formula, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. It's worth looking carefully at this passage, for the subduing and restraining aspect of right mindfulness is often overlooked. The word subduing, vinaya, is related to the word for discipline, vinaya. Also, I think as it literally, vinaya literally means to lead away from. Something like that, leading away from, leading out from. This suggests that greed and distress are not yet uprooted in this part of the practice. They are simply put aside and kept in check. The tense of the verb, it's a gerund, can mean either having subdued or subduing. In other words, the activity is either already accomplished or in the process of being accomplished. Both meanings are appropriate here, in that greed and distress have to be brought under a measure of control simply to start the process of establishing mindfulness. Because they are not yet uprooted, they have to be continually put aside as they arise. As for the word world in this passage, this has two meanings in the canon. In general usage, as when the Buddha refers to the world with its devas, maras, brahmas, etc., or as to the world of beings to whom the four immeasurable attitudes of goodwill, metta, karuna, mudita, upeka, are directed, world means the ordinary sense of the world outside, a place in which we move and interact with other beings. On a more technical level, world simply means the six senses, the data they transmit, and the feelings they engender. And then he illustrates that by a quote from Samyutta 35, Sutta number 82. Then a certain monk went to the Blessed One, and on arrival, having bowed down to him, sat to one side. As he was sitting there, he said to the Blessed One, the world, it is said, in what respect does the word world apply? And it's loka. Loka is world. Insofar as it disintegrates, lujjati, monk, it's called the world. Now what disintegrates? The eye disintegrates. Forms disintegrate. Consciousness at the eye disintegrates. Contact at the eye disintegrates. And whatever there is that arises independent on contact at the eye, experienced as pleasure and pain, and neither pleasure nor pain, that too disintegrates. The ear disintegrates. Sounds disintegrate. The nose disintegrates. Aromas disintegrate. The tongue disintegrates. Taste disintegrate. The body disintegrates. Tactile sensations disintegrate. The intellect disintegrates. Ideas disintegrate. Consciousness at the intellect disintegrates. Contact at the intellect disintegrates. And whatever there is that arises independence on contact at the intellect, experienced as pleasure, pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, that too disintegrates. Insofar as it disintegrates, it's called the world. Because events known purely at the intellect are included in this list, this second sense of the word world covers not only sensory input from the world outside, but also any input dealing with inner worlds of the mind, such as the states of becoming induced by the practice of right concentration. As we will see, this point has important applications in the practice. Apparently, the word world in the last part of the Satipatthana formula covers both senses of the word. On the one hand, the act of subduing greed and distress with reference to the world is a way of keeping your frame of reference with, for example, the body in and of itself, and not allowing that frame of reference to shift to the world in which the body moves and to which it relates. In other words, You pay no attention to the body as viewed in the context of the world outside, as to whether it's attractive to others, strong enough to do work, etc., and instead attend strictly to the issues of the body in and of itself. On the other hand, the act of subduing greed and distress with reference to the world of the six senses is a way of not allowing any extraneous sense data to interfere with the work at hand, that of getting mindfulness established and keeping it established in line with its duties on the path. At a later stage, the act of subduing is also a way of overcoming any attachment to the worlds of becoming created by the practice of right mindfulness itself. So, considering this passage in line with both meanings of world, it's easy to see that one of the important duties of mindfulness is to remember the right effort of restraint, the need to exclude any mental frameworks that would dislodge the proper frame of reference, and to exclude any defilements that would interfere with the proper actions in line with that framework. Okay, any questions? Okay, good. This point is illustrated by two similes in the canon. The first simile shows the dangers of leaving the territory of Satipatthana and wandering off into the territory of sensual pleasures. And this is from Samyutta 47, Sutta number 7. And 47 is actually the Satipatthana Samyutta. There are in the Himalayas, the king of mountains, difficult, uneven areas where neither monkeys wander nor human beings. There are difficult, uneven areas where monkeys wander, but not human beings. There are level stretches of land, delightful, where monkeys wander, and so do human beings. There, hunters set a tar trap in the monkeys' trails in order to catch the monkeys. There, those monkeys who are not foolish or careless by nature, on seeing the tar trap, avoid it from afar. But any monkey who is foolish and careless by nature comes up to the tar trap and grabs it with his paw. He gets stuck there, thinking, "I'll free my paw." He grabs it with his other paw. He gets stuck there, thinking, "I'll free both of my paws." He grabs it with his foot. He gets stuck there, thinking, "I'll free both of my paws and my foot." He grabs it with his other foot. He gets stuck there, thinking, "I'll free both of my paws and my feet as well." He grabs it with his mouth. He gets stuck there. So, the monkey snared in five ways, and this is in brackets here, symbolizing the five strings of sensuality described below, lies there whimpering, having fallen on misfortune, fallen on ruin, a prey to whatever the hunter wants to do with him. Then the hunter, without releasing the monkey, skewers him right there, picks him up, and goes off as he likes. This is what happens to anyone who wanders into what is not his proper range and is the territory of others. For this reason, you should not wander into what is not your proper range and is the territory of others. In one who wanders into what is not his proper range and is the territory of others, Mara gains an opening. Mara gains a foothold. And what, for a monk, is not his proper range and is the territory of others? The five strings of sensuality. Which five? Forms cognizable by the eye, agreeable, pleasing, charming, endearing, fostering desire, enticing. Sounds cognizable by the ear, smells cognizable by the nose, tastes cognizable by the tongue, tactile sensations cognizable by the body, agreeable, pleasing, charming, endearing, fostering desire, enticing. These, for a monk, are not his proper range and are the territory of others. Wander, monks, in what is your proper range, your own ancestral territory. In one who wanders in what is his proper range, his own ancestral territory, Mara gains no opening, Mara gains no foothold. And what for a monk is his proper range, his own ancestral territory? The four establishings of mindfulness. This for a monk is his proper range, his own ancestral territory. The other simile shows the safety that comes when you can stay within the territory of a proper frame of reference and are able to subdue any greed and distress with regard to the world of sensual pleasures. And this is Samyutta 47, Sutta number 6. Once a hawk suddenly swooped down on a quail and seized it. Then the quail, as it was being carried off by the hawk, lamented, "Oh, just my bad luck and luck of merit that I was wandering out of my proper range and into the territory of others. If only I had kept to my proper range today, to my own ancestral territory, this hawk would have been no match for me in battle." "But what quail is your proper range?" the hawk asked. "What is your own ancestral territory?" "A newly plowed field with clumps of earth all turned up." So the hawk, proud of its own strength, without mentioning its own strength, let go of the quail. "Go, quail, but even having gone there, you won't escape me." Then the quail, having gone to a newly plowed field with clumps of earth all turned up, and climbing up on top of a large clump of earth, stood taunting the hawk. "Come for me now, you hawk! Come for me now, you hawk!" And so the hawk, proud of its own strength, without mentioning its own strength, folded its two wings and suddenly swooped down toward the quail. When the quail knew, "The hawk is coming at me at full speed," it slipped behind the clump of earth, and right there the hawk shattered its breast. This is what happens to anyone who wanders into what is not his proper range and is the territory of others. For this reason, you should not wander into what is not your proper range and is the territory of others. In one who wanders into what is not his proper range and is the territory of others, Mara gains an opening, Mara gains a foothold. And what for a monk is not his proper range and is the territory of others, the five strings of sensuality. Because one of the first steps of right concentration practice is to seclude the mind from sensuality, these similes show how the act of subduing greed and distress with reference to the world leads the practice of right mindfulness directly into the practice of right concentration. That's that phrase that I brought up last night in the talk. Viviceva gamehi. Okay. Any questions?
One reflection that has occurred to me is that, as Americans in particular, the phrase ancestral territory just doesn't carry the oomph. We don't know what that means. And I remember.
It's actually, I mean, if you look at your passport, you'll see what's your ancestral territory. It's this picture of satellites beaming down the whole earth. This is sort of Americans' idea of their ancestral territory. Okay, that was a snide comment. Ah, right.
And so, I mean, one of them, I think she was an Oneida. She knew this, not many acres left, but this was their patch of what's now. And if her, she could trace her lineage back generations, and this was their land.
Yeah.
I can just imagine the feeling of, I'm here, I know every inch of this, totally my blood. And then if she gets, say, goes into the city, how different that must feel. Totally not at home. And I think that's sort of what this is trying to convey.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, it's quite, just locally in this area. Native Americans, the Pomo, well, actually all the different tribes in Northern California generally, would have a... They were so familiar with their land that each of... Because the oak trees were traditionally your source of food, and each oak tree had its name and had its... And inherited... it was passed on... It was matrilineal. So it passed on through the women who owned those. And everybody knew and what the names were. And so with the coming of the white man who sort of drove them off the land, took them all up to Round Valley, I mean, just up past Willits, and all the different tribe, and they were just, you can imagine how disoriented they were, because it wasn't their ancestral territory, didn't know what the boundaries were, didn't know what belonged to anybody. Very, very confusing.
Kind of a curious question with the five strings of sensuality.
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, that not being appropriate territory, appropriate terrain. Just wondering, I was just thinking about why not the sixth sense base, the intellect, and how we get so lost in those skillful thoughts and feelings and musings and fantasies.
I think, this is just a guess. I think, one, because I don't think, say, it has this... It doesn't have the same tangible nature as a physical sense base and a physical sense object. So that I think the Buddha treated it somewhat differently. And I think also to a certain degree the obsession with the intellect is more of a modern aberration, really. Probably in the Western world, probably say subsequent to the Enlightenment age. The age of reason, and then the reifying of the intellect and the mind, and I see I compare it to, say, like Northeast Thailand, they just find us really amusing. It's like, well, you sure think a lot. It just isn't that important to them. So, but, you know, so those, both of those elements, I think one is the substantial nature of that, even though, certainly in the Buddha's time, the Buddha was familiar with the worlds that people created internally. But I think there's a substantial quality to those five strings of sensuality that they're tangible, and there's a different quality of quest for gratification. I think it has a much more tangible nature, and as opposed to the intellect itself. Yeah.
That was the Enlightenment, was in 1600s? Or The Enlightenment, the Age of Reason,
1600s? So, yeah, 16th century, beginning of 1500, I think. Beginning, I can't remember where they where they, what's the defining point?
Could it also be that, I mean, obviously there's lots of unskillful mental states and unskillful mental pleasures, but also like, say, the piti and sukha of samadhi, and could that be considered a sort of mano?
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's in the same way. There's all sorts of innocent sensual pleasures as well that are
body based,
and
have a basis in the
this is true too, piti and sukha. But I'm also just sort of thinking, even within the realm of the strands of sensuality, it's that kind of obsession. The pleasure per se isn't necessary to the problem. It's that seeking, and so there's all sorts of innocent pleasures through the senses that one experiences, in the same way that there's innocent pleasures that one experiences through the mind.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's the desire and the aversion related to any other matter.
Yes. Yes, that abhijja dhammanasa is that greed and distress toward the world.
Another difference between the five strands of sensual pleasure and the sixth sense base is that the sixth sense base can actually be used as a basis for awakening, where the instructions to Bhavya in the scene, only the scene, where at least I think that's right. Okay. My understanding is that the sixth sense basis, reflection on them, can be used as a means for awakening. Whereas reflection on, and the same is not the case for the five cords of sensual pleasure.
I don't think there's a clear line between them. I mean, the cords of sensual pleasure are the sense bases. It's just how it's approached, or the attitude that.
Yeah, it's the same avenue.
Same avenue. Yeah.
I have a question. Yeah, particularly the phrases used was the sensual pleasures and their delightful of these different five strands. Just what I'm saying, I've kind of noticed in my own mind, is that while I can get sort of obsessive about pleasures, I can also get obsessive about painful things. and I'm wondering why those weren't highlighted in that.
Well, I think that it's the more common, element is the. I mean, the Buddha, he can only say so much in any instruction, in any particular instruction. Otherwise, one instruction then takes the 19 volumes of the suttas. So I think it's just your more common element that trips us up, and then you start extrapolating from that, or you start seeing the drawback in that.
It also seems like the aversion to the painful is rooted in the desire for the pleasant.
Right. Yeah. That's another aspect of. By highlighting one, the other is implicit. They're not really separate. It's that as soon as there's separation from the pleasure, then it's that sort of fear of the painful, or fear of separation from the pleasant is pain. So then there, by just drawing one, then you can start. If you extrapolate from it, then you've got the whole package. Yeah.
And reflecting on kind of the five chords versus, it's the sense space of the mind. Could it be that the five chords need an outside stimulus to be activated, whereas the mind is this kind of internal frame of reference.
Yes, yes, I think that's probably true as well. Yeah, those are your setting up. Those five are quite distinct in that way, where it's an internal and external kind of codependence. Whereas, with the mind, then it's you can on its own can create its own worlds, universes. Yeah.
And also, I mean, just to continue my line of thought from before, I think it dovetails nicely with that, and that sort of the idea behind giving up the five core essential pleasures is partially to develop samadhi, so that your craving for pleasant sensation comes from something that doesn't depend so much on the fragility or the fragile
nature of the external. Yeah.
So that's my understanding, is use the pleasure samadhi to replace or to refine your craving for the five cores.
That's true, because that's very explicit in I can't remember which what the name of the sutta is in Majjhima Nikaya. It's a very, very clear where you're taking the you're replacing the pleasure that one gains through the sense bases of, through the cords of sensual pleasure, replacing it with the pleasure of samadhi of the internal pleasure that comes from the mind itself, whereas it's steeped in wholesome dhammas and is settled in concentration.